part 8 of 9 from set number 3014, The Great Magicians, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Simon Magus, the Gnostic Magician.
And with that, I think we can now devote ourselves to this evening's topic, which deals primarily and ostensibly with the figure of the man, as far as we know from historical records, who might indeed qualify as the first Gnostic, and that is the mysterious and controversial Simon Magus, or Simon the Magician. But in connection with that, we will try to continue to develop certain ideas about the magical relationship and the magical aspects of the Gnostic teachings, of the Gnostic philosophy, whether they are directly related to Simon Magus or not. Let me perhaps recapitulate in a couple of sentences some of the ideas that we expressed 2 weeks ago in the beginning of our series, where we mentioned that magic, which again is a very much misunderstood and controversial term. People's misunderstanding range all the way from stage magic, the pulling of rabbits out of hats and that kind of delightful activity, to the casting of spells and evoking of demons and things of that sort. And needless to say, we are not really concerned here with either of those activities. We mentioned on the last occasion that magic, the proper meaning of the term, is closely related to an old Indo-Aryan root word mag, M-A-G, from whence we derive such terms even in English as magnitude and magnification and others, and which of course has to do with greatness, coming to us through the Latin. And that this, as various experts have pointed out in the past, this needs to be understood in the sense that from the beginning of human life, as far as we know, there has always been a desire on the part of human consciousness to enlarge itself. That perhaps the consciousness of our mental and indeed spiritual smallness is one of the earliest and in many ways most powerful recognitions of the human mind. And no doubt we project and misunderstand this inward recognition very frequently, and we come to imagine that what we need is perhaps more room on the earth, larger territory, larger real estate, bigger house, more money, more of this or more of that. But as we perhaps employ ourselves in that regard and accumulate various worldly possessions and thereby have more of those, we still remain unsatisfied and dissatisfied, and eventually we frequently discover that what we truly are in need of is an enlargement of our consciousness, is an enlargement of our interior spiritual being. And that from a Gnostic point of view, this inward feeling, this inward longing, may also be connected with certain teachings of the Gnostic mythos, which tend to tell us that we have not always been confined to the kind of circumstances wherein we find ourselves now, that we were truly much larger in consciousness, that we were the partakers of an ineffable greatness, of a truly great fullness of some sort at one time. And for reasons that we need not go into at this particular time, so we find in the Gnostic mythos, we have exited from that fullness. and our consciousness has become constricted. Our nature has become small. We have become degraded, which simply means losing a higher status, a higher grade, and entering a lower grade, such as, if I don't know, from a sophomore, you are made a freshman again, or something of that sort. And that this existential condition, while we have no detailed memory of it, does torment us in various ways. And it is the result of this existential condition that our ever-present desire for more consciousness, for a greater fullness, for a greatness exists. And that what has been called magic has been certainly one of the avenues, one of the disciplines whereby people throughout both the known and the unknown history of humankind have tried to enlarge their consciousness. That magic indeed was that endeavor, or one of the very important endeavors, whereby we tried to break through the barriers that exist in our earthly existence and come to a greater world, primarily perhaps, initially at least, to a kind of intermediate region, which most spiritual traditions, especially the esoteric ones, have tended to emphasize and to point out, exists between our limited earthly existence and the realm of ultimate transcendence. Because the magical worldview, the esoteric worldview, the Gnostic worldview, was always cognizant of these rather large intermediate spheres, aeons. In the Kabbalah, perhaps we might call them the olams, the worlds with their sephirot, that exist between embodied existence on the one end and total transcendence on the other. Now, with that little recapitulation of earlier material, we may first address ourselves a bit to the story of Simon. And you will bear with me if some of the biographical and bibliographical portions here may not contain a great deal of magic right away. But I promise you, come back to the magical content and the magical message implicit in the story of Simon and explicitly stated there also. Simon Magus, or Simon the Magician, is often credited with being the first Gnostic. And if we can give credence to these accounts, then that is really not far from the truth. Now, of course, it somewhat depends the accuracy of such a statement, somewhat depends on our own definition of who or what is Gnostic. Certainly there is a legitimate, wider, latitudinarian definition. And if we go along with that definition, then we perhaps come rather close to what the Gnostics themselves have said, namely that Gnosis, the experience of transcendence, has always been in the world, and that based upon it and connected with it, there were always Gnostics in the world. But of course, that is a contention, as likely as it appears, that is very difficult to substantiate historically. And therefore, for our own purposes, need to have a point of historical beginning that we can pinpoint. And there we might say that chronologically, in the early Christian history, it would seem that this mysterious figure of Simon the Magician is the earliest. And as we will see, even from the brief and inadequate and fragmentary summary of some of his teachings, much that later unfolded at the hands of such great Gnostic sages and seers and writers as, for instance, Valentinus and Basilides and Marcion, Bardesanes and others, was at least in a somewhat more brief, a somewhat more seminal fashion, present already in the teachings of Simon. So almost everything that is basic and truly significant for the Gnostic philosophy was present in Simon's teachings and activities already, as far as we are able to determine. But now, who was he? According to the various reports that we have, just like Jesus, just like Jesus' apostles, just like John the Baptizer, or later on Philo of Alexandria, Simon was a Jew. But he was a Jew from a particular district or a particular province of Judea, from Samaria, and therefore he was called, with his other compatriots, a Samaritan, because that is how such folk are called in the New Testament. The Jews of Samaria, the Samaritans, were kind of natural-born heretics to begin with. Somewhere along the line in their history, they developed an approach to their ancestral Jewish religion, which was different from the majority. They refused, for instance, to worship at the temple in Jerusalem. And that's certainly a big difference. They had a sacred mountain of their own, and that is where they conducted their religious ceremonies. So in many ways they were already on the fringe, on the margin of Jewish society and of Jewish religion. It was a hotbed of unusual spirituality. The accounts of the life of Simon are confused, primarily because of the fierce hostility evinced toward him by the anti-Gnostic Christian writers, by the so-called heresiologist writers. And it is that hostility that has also filtered into at least one book of the New Testament, into the Acts of the Apostles, where in the 8th chapter a not very favorable mention is made of Simon. And then, of course, this hostility continued with other anti-heretical writers such as Epiphanius and Irenaeus and others, particularly in a work called Philosophumena, which is attributed to Hippolytus. Now, what we need to remember about these sources, not only in connection with Simon, but generally with the documentation of the Gnostic tradition, is that, as this so often happens, these hostile writers, nevertheless, in spite of their hostility, and sometimes perhaps because of it, also shared a good deal of information with us about Gnostic personages and Gnostic teachings. Not that so much of their reporting is reliable, but if one sifts the pejorative comments, and if one takes out some of the hostility, then certain quotations and certain summaries of Gnostic writings remain, which are still quite valuable. In fact, for an incredibly long period of time, for a good 1700 years or thereabouts, with the exception of some of the Gnosticizing acts, like the Acts of John, for instance, and some others, these hostile writings of the heresiologists were the only source of information that we possessed about the Gnostics. That there were insightful and creative people in our culture, or just picking one or two at random, people like Jacob Böhme and William Blake, and others who had only these writings really available to them, and they still managed to, let's say, work their way through to the central features of the Gnostic teachings is remarkable. You know, it wasn't really until the late 18th century and then the 19th century and the 20th century that at an accelerating rate original Gnostic writings were discovered and translated and made available. The earliest ones, and I don't want to spend too much time on that, just sort of started turning up right before the French Revolution around that time in the most peculiar way, in the most unusual places, such as the Bruce Codex, original Gnostic and very, very magical writing, all of a sudden just showed up in England in somebody's house. Nobody knew how it got there. Later on, the same thing was true of the Askew Codex that contains Pistis Sophia, other writings of that sort. The Odes of Solomon were just found again on some shelf somewhere. Nobody knew how it got there. And you know, these things had to come somehow from Egypt and the Middle East. Of course, a lot of Englishmen traveled back and forth and they picked up weird old things. They thought they might come in handy at some point and they put them down somewhere, forgot about them. But fortunately, quite a few of these were discovered by scholars. But up to that time, these heresiology church fathers and their statements about Gnostics and Gnostic teachings were just about all we had. And unfortunately, to a major extent, that is still all we have concerning Simon, but it is still quite interesting. So many uncomplimentary things were said by these church fathers about Simon, but a residue of highly interesting biographical and theoretical material remains. It is more than likely that being the first undisguised, identifiable Gnostic, he received practically all or at least the majority of the negative projections of the Orthodox party, which this Orthodox party nourished against the Gnostics. And it is thus not impossible that the heresiological writers fused or combined more than one person in their accounts of Simon Magus, purely in order to effectively blacken his name, because it's difficult to find one person whom you can plausibly accuse of so many misdeeds all at once. You know, this has always been a problem. When, for instance, the great orator and sort of the great grandfather of all trial lawyers for all ages to come, Cicero, because that's what he was, Marcus Tullius Cicero, you know, when he gave his great famous peroration against Catiline or Catilina, he threw in so many accusations against Catilina that he himself had to kind of apologize for them, and he would then sort of disavow some of them, like, you know, he would accuse him of everything in the world, from murder to incest to robbery to disloyalty to the Roman state, and then he would say, but I have also heard, although this, he says, I can't believe that he dances sometimes. Dances. You know, for a Roman patrician to lower himself to actually dancing, like a dancing bear or a dancing girl, or a bear dancing girl, or whichever way it is, was so damaging that even Cicero just sort of threw it in like a lawyer would. Well, some people say this, but I can't really believe that either. So this is a little bit the way that people treated poor old Simon as well. There were several persons who emerged, of course, and this is quite important, I think, during the first century, from what might very well have been a pre-existent Jewish secret tradition. At least that is my feeling. That the Gnostics were really accurate in their statement that their worldview, their outlook has always been in the world. Why? Because there have always been people in the world who became partakers of the unusual states of consciousness which they called gnosis. And therefore they would then bring forth and talk about a similar worldview. And so it is quite likely that people like Simon merely brought out into the open certain elements of Gnostic or proto-Gnostic, early Gnostic teaching that were already circulating underground. But in addition to that, there is a very interesting phenomenon which is not really remarked upon very often. The interest in that early period, the first 2-3 centuries of Christendom, is increasing. You know, in popular publications such as, for instance, U.S. News and World Report, the Easter issue of the year 2001 wasn't writing about Jesus or about the resurrection or things like that, but about the story of early Christianity and the early Christian heresies, including Gnostics. They didn't even call us all that bad names, and so forth. So the interest, you know, is there and exists, but somehow this particular circumstance, which I'm going to touch on now, is hardly ever mentioned, and that is that a sort of constellation of what might be called a messianic impulse was taking place right around the first century and perhaps a little bit before. Something was trying to happen. A new spiritual impulse was trying to burst forth, apparently, in the world. It was almost like a spiritual or a psychological bringing to birth, and the kind of labor that precedes bringing to birth, with all of its sad defects. That film that they made a number of years ago, the movie about motion picture about the last temptation of Christ, which I felt had pretty bad casting. Most of the apostles looked as if they belonged into a delicatessen rather than into a first century Jerusalem, and, you know, various things like that. But with all of that, it did convey, especially in certain scenes, the ferment, the painful expectation of some great salvific spiritual event. Even the music with the ancient instruments that they used, the kind of wailing, crying, an atmosphere of intense and painful expectancy. Now, this seems to actually have been the case. And it would seem that several figures responded to that expectancy and were at least kind of potential messianic figures. One of these, of course, is very well known, is John the Baptizer, whom I don't like to call Baptist because he did not belong to an American Protestant sect of relatively late provenance. And John the Baptizer apparently had a sort of school of his own. And that school turned out to be kind of almost like a school of messiahs. And his initiatory procedure was the watery baptism, to which, of course, according to the New Testament, he subjected Jesus as well. But there were others. Now, to say that somebody ran a school of messiahs sounds strange, but it's really not all that atypical as far as Jewish history and tradition is concerned, for there exists an account and a transmission that ever since the days of the prophet Elijah, which of course, you know, goes back to the prophetic age, there was a school of the prophets which functioned on the mountain of Carmel. And Mount Carmel, of course, then became a very important sacred place to the Christian tradition. And that is, it was in honor of Mount Carmel and its traditions and the appearance of the particular later in the time of the Crusades, an apparition of the Blessed Virgin at Mount Carmel that the famous Carmelite order was founded, to which such great mystics like St. John of the Cross, San Juan de la Cruz, and the noted Teresa of Avila and others belonged. And I have conversed with Carmelites about that, and they definitely stated that the Carmelite order was cognizant of their origins within the school of the prophets. They like to connect themselves with that even into Old Testamentary times. So just like there was a school of the prophets, it would seem there was a sort of a school of messianic figures that was led by John the Baptizer. And out of this group of John the Baptizer, there arose a number of figures that we hear about, who all sort of became messianic figures in their own right, as indeed John himself became that. Because to this day there exists a most interesting and lovely religion, the members of which reside now primarily in Iraq and Iran, although some of them have fled that turbulent area in recent years and are now in other places, United States and Europe and Australia as well. The so-called Mandeans, who get their name from Manda, which is in Mandaic, which is their ancient language, means gnosis. And the Mandeans revere John the Baptizer as the Messiah. He occupies the same role pretty much for them that Jesus occupies for the Christians. In every other respects, they are total Gnostics. Very, very interesting tradition. And so John certainly played that role. And then, no doubt, his most important and ultimately most famous initiate was Jesus. But there was also Simon, who came from Samaria and who learned and was under and was initiated by John. There was yet another one about whom we know very little. We only know his name, Doshtai, in Greek called Dositius, who according to the records came from Arabia and then went back and started a school in Arabia himself. Now, from this academy of messiahship apparently came Simon. Jung, Carl Gustav Jung, incidentally, whom, as most of you are aware, I consider to be a man of singular insight in so many respects, Jung in his writings mentioned that he felt that a messianic archetype was sort of trying to manifest in the Middle Eastern region for a considerable period of time, at least a century, maybe even more, and that it came to its culmination then in the figure of Jesus. But that there were other sort of little messianic flare-ups as well. In any event, messiahship was very much in the air and then also present in the activities of a number of people. The messianic archetype, if we may call it that, which is, you know, a very specific kind of a manifestation. There are various manifestations of that sort, and that is one of them. But along with that, and it's important for our purposes, for Simon, there was also something else that was trying to take place. And we will come back to that in various ways, especially, God willing, in our lecture in connection with the magic of Sophia. That beginning sometime prior to the first century, we can also notice the emerging of a feminine archetype, that of the wisdom of God. Chokmah in Hebrew, Sophia in Greek. Most of you are familiar with the fact that it appears in an entire literature in the Old Testament, the book of Proverbs, the book of the Wisdom of Solomon, and quite a few others, including Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiasticus, and eventually finds its way into the works of that most important great Jewish philosopher and theologian Philo, and into the writings of the Gnostics. Now, we need to keep in mind, and I won't spend too much time on this now because there will be other opportunities, we need to keep in mind that this wisdom archetype, just like the messianic archetype, also is a very specific one. People, even scholars sometimes, fall prey to the tendency to overgeneralize. And so we have a literature which was probably initiated to a major extent sort of in the 1970s or so by a scholar named Raphael Patai, very fine scholar incidentally, called The Jewish Goddess. I think his book is still around. And then various people picked it up, also a lot of not really very reputable kind of flapdoodle popular writers. And in many of these works, the archetype of Chokhmah Sophia is confounded with all kinds of other goddess figures. And that's a mistake, because specificity is also a quality of spiritual things and of spiritual beings and archetypes and so forth. Even if you look at, let's say, a big, really large polytheistic pantheon, at the present time perhaps the only one being that of the Hindus, vast numbers of gods and goddesses, yet each and every one of those has a very specific character. There is no overlap, there is no transgressivity really between them. They're very specific figures. That allows, of course, let's say the Hindu devotee to choose from them. That's the concept that is in Sanskrit is called Ishta Devata, the chosen deity. If they were all the same, there wouldn't be all that point of choosing. And so the wisdom archetype is also a very specific one. And it really has to do with an inspiring and sanctifying quality of consciousness. It's not named Chokhmah or wisdom without good reason, but it is still a specific, not only a quality of mind, which we say, well, he is wise, he has wisdom, but it is also envisioned as a being in the higher worlds. And this being is the one from whom wisdom comes into the soul, into the spirit of people. This is the agency that makes the wise wise. Even as the Messiah is the agency who makes the soul free. And the two are an extremely important combination. Now, the reason I brought this up is because the reports are that Simon, once he began his teaching mission, was not alone, but had with him a woman named Helen, or at least he named her Helen. Now, you know, the name Helen, maybe there is somebody here named Helen, Helena, you know, is derived originally from the Greek Selene, Helene, Selene, that S changes into an H at a certain point, which is the name of the moon, and of the moon goddess. So there is a lunar quality to the name. But Simon, apparently, according to the reports, had combined this figure, who was then his companion and co-teacher, so to say, with a very particular spiritual theory, which is very interesting. But first, a little bit of the accusations, because with their proverbial preoccupation with sex and with prostitutes, the church fathers provided the wonderful information, or perhaps misinformation, that Helen had been a prostitute in the coastal city of Tyre, and that Simon had purchased her from a brothel. When you want to discredit somebody, then as now, sexually toned accusations have always proven to be highly effective, for which reason I think they will continue to remain part of the preoccupations of politicians, well, until the end of the aeon, which will be the end of politics, we hope, and the end of lawyers as well. Now, this is the way in which these hostile sources of perhaps disinformation try to dispose of the mysterious legend of Simon and Helen. One may keep in mind that a similar role was, probably also falsely, attributed to Mary Magdalene. Modern biblical scholarship tends to feel that there is no valid evidence indicating that Mary Magdalene had anything to do with being a prostitute. In all likelihood, something similar may be assumed regarding Helen. The legend of Helen, as told by Simon, and as recorded by some of the church fathers, who perhaps in this regard may be given a certain amount of credence, is to the effect that, and I'll come back to that a little bit later perhaps also, that coming from the primordial deity, just very much along the line of Gnostic aeonology, there are two powers. One may be regarded as masculine in tone, and this one is the saving and enlightening and teaching kind of power, and the other one is the power of thought, ennoia, called in Greek, and also wisdom. And the wisdom power, said Simon, now mind you, this is earlier than any of the Sophia myths, certainly at least 150, 200 years minimum older than Pistis Sophia and older than probably all of the Nag Hammadi writings with the possible exception of Thomas. And he says that the wisdom principle, which was feminine, came down from the heavenly region and underwent a series of embodiments on earth. So a reincarnational kind of situation is definitely present in Simon's teachings, although not necessarily applied to everyone, because you have to keep that in mind. A lot of reincarnationists think whoever taught reincarnation taught that everybody undergoes reincarnation. Yes, some people taught that, many people taught that, but there are also some teachings which teach that certain special people do that sort of thing because there is a need for them to come back again and again. Just like, let's say, in ancient Egypt, as well as in ancient China, not everybody is assumed to be immortal. The old Egyptians, and I think also the old Chinese, had a very practical notion that most people are so worthless that no one would be that much better off if they were immortal. It's just as well for them to die and get the heck out of the picture. Now this may not be very flattering for some of us, but it definitely was the underlying thought. But those who have attained to a high development of consciousness, on the other hand, those become, as the ancient Chinese called them, the immortals. And the immortals are the ones who have become so wise that the universe cannot get along without them. And therefore, they have to stay here and they have to come back again and again. So this is the concept of earned immortality. C.G. Jung, to whom I always come back, as you know, I guess just I orbit around him like a planet around the sun. C.G. Jung once went to with a friend of his to some gigantic athletic event. You couldn't really quite think that Dr. Jung would be interested in that, but he went. It was undoubtedly a soccer game because those are the big athletic events in Switzerland and around there. And so he and his friend came into this gigantic arena, thousands and thousands of people. Jung looked around and he said, He says, look at all of them. You see all of these people here? And they all want to be immortal. That was his comment. But of course, he also indicated at other times that there is a kind of immortality that is bestowed by individuation. Not the kind of immortality that makes you go on and on in time, which is a rather sad immortality in my view, because here you are thrown back into the same kind of balderdash over and over again, the same muck and mire, but the kind of immortality that lifts you out of time and above time. And if you have, as I'm sure, knowingly or unknowingly, whether you remember or not, probably all of you have experienced at least a few minutes of timelessness at some point or the other. It can come in all kinds of ways. And when you experience that timelessness, then you sort of see that within that consciousness, birth, death, and all that goes between doesn't make all that much difference. It doesn't mean anything. It has been rendered relative. It doesn't amount to a hill of beans, as the rural metaphor would have it. And I don't really know how much a hill of beans amounts to, but I guess it was a pretty cheap commodity much of the time. So this kind of immortality. So here we have in the teaching about Helen, if you don't mind using the Sanskrit word, that Helen was an avatar of wisdom, an embodiment, and again, of this wise principle. But the people who came in contact with her in course of these incarnations, of course, were not wise. Maybe she was there because they were not wise. She was trying to render them wise, make them wise up, as we say. But of course, in their unwisdom, they didn't recognize her for who she was, but they were usually stirred up in some fashion or the other by her. And the grand example of that was her embodiment as Helen of Troy, supposedly according to Simon. Now here again, we need to keep in mind a certain context that most people are not aware of, that Helen of Troy was an unbelievably important figure to the mythic mind of the ancient world. She was, and I don't mean to make one-to-one analogies here, but I would say her figure was every bit as important to the Greco-Roman and Greco-Egyptian world as the Virgin Mary was to medieval Europe. Extremely important. And with her, the entire story of the Trojan War was also of supreme importance. It was sort of the great central myth of the Greek mind, and because of the Greek influence, it was everywhere. So it is by no means fortuitous that Simon should have pointed that out, because everybody was interested in Helen of Troy. And everybody considered her, not only that is this extremely beautiful woman, but a mystery figure, a magic woman of major proportions. And her magical qualities run all through the story of the Trojan War. For instance, when the Greeks arrive with their ships, they pull in the harbor near Troy looking for her, because that's what they came for. They're trying to figure out, well, where could she be? And then they over a particular building, they see a great big light. They say, oh, that's where she is. Okay. So, ordinary people don't emit large lights where they live. This is somebody with very special quality. So Simon says there was one of her last embodiments. And of course, with this, he apparently wove in typical Gnostic fashion already, sort of the entire myth that what all these people were looking for was wisdom, and that they came to liberate wisdom, which is what he was trying to do. That Helen was confined in Troy. She was captive. they came to liberate her. And that the wisdom is held captive in this world. That the lower forces grab her and try to somehow subvert her power to their own ends. Of course, they still never become truly wise, but they try. As in a later version of the story in Pistis Sophia, they try to steal her light all the time. And that is, of course, what they are trying to do here. This is somehow always the way it is in the world. The sort of power-hungry, brutal people, the dictators and these various archonic powers, have an underlying intuition that something is powerful, something is valuable, and they try to get their claws on it. You could see that with Hitler in certain situations. You could certainly see it all over with the communist powers, and especially in the relationship of the Marxist-communist powers, for instance, to religion. Because, of course, they are all, by definition, irreligious and anti-religious, but they still try to dominate religion. You can't read a Bible in mainland China today by law, according to the reports that we have, unless it's approved by the government. Mm-hmm. It's a very inquisitorial kind of thing. Stalin did the same thing. Try to dominate the religious situation, even though you don't believe in it. You think it's total balderdash. But somehow, you know, there is power in there. There is something in there. We don't understand it. We can't figure it out. We don't know how it works. But we will have to sit on it and control it. Now, it's that kind of a principle that Simon is talking about regarding the feminine wisdom that comes from the aeons, that comes from the heavens. These lower forces try to dominate it, try to subjugate it, try to rape it, try to do all of these things because they know that there is something very valuable there, even though they can't quite identify it. And then, when it comes to Simon's own time, then Simon becomes the liberator, and he finds Helen. And he brings her out of whatever confinement he is in. This is the story that has been turned into the story of a prostitute by Simon's enemies. And now she becomes his co-teacher. And the two of them together go out now in the world, Simon the great power and Helen, the embodiment of divine mind and of wisdom, and they bring, they don't call it that yet, their particular kind of gnosis to the world. Now, a little more about it later. Now, behind the story, there exists apparently also quite a bit of theory or doctrine attributed to Simon. As with many other Gnostic teachers, we do not possess an original work by Simon. But we have summaries as well as what appear to be direct quotations in the writings of several of these church fathers. For the sake of completeness, I will mention them very quickly, and then I'll go on to the magical part, as I promised. One of the, apparently the chief work of Simon, according to these accounts, was the Great Announcement, which is mainly presented by Hippolytus, and in which clear indications of a true classical Gnostic system are present. A universal parent, more or less androgynous overall, and from this come the Logos, the great power and the world soul as the divine feminine, and the creation of the sensible world, the world perceptible to our senses, occurs at the hand of imperfect builders, and then the female world soul becomes involved in that world and is captured and tormented by these builders. Now, here again, a great break with the existing official Jewish tradition, because the creator is no longer Jehovah, but lower intermediate beings. Now, it needs to be, of course, kept in mind that at that time, this was probably not as oh, I don't know, as weird and as off-putting in its sound as it might be to a lot of people now after 2,000 years of monotheistic conditioning. Why? Because something of a similar nature was certainly circulating rather freely among the Greeks. Then the concept of demiurgos was very common in Greek philosophy. Plato and the Platonists, the Neoplatonists, clear down to Plotinus and Iamblichus and Proclus and all, they all talked about the demiurgos. They said that Zeus and the various Olympian gods themselves would not create. That was not their thing. I suppose they rather enjoyed themselves than make worlds. So would I. But that they had a craftsman, a builder, an architect, and he is the one who made worlds and things like that. And this architect wasn't always not that smart. And that's why he sometimes built things that didn't work all that well, including so many things in our world. You know, the Greeks were very practical about that sort of thing. If something didn't look good to them, they said so. And so we find the reappearance of that here, which of course then becomes an extremely important element of the Gnostic myth. Another work that we hear about regarding Simon are the four quarters of the world, of which we have very little information. The Sermons of the Refuter, in which there is quite a bit of argumentation against the system of Moses and the monotheistic God. And also, somewhere along there is apparently a treatise in which Simon aligns himself symbolically, very powerfully, with the pre-Socratic, the Ionic fire philosophers, especially Heraclitus, where he says that the most important element, far more important than earth and water and air, is fire, and that this fire is really the metaphor for the spirit. And as far as we are able to discern, he uses the fire metaphor for the description of all sorts of spiritual things. Now what we need to take a look at, of course, is why is Simon called the magician? And here we find, I think, already the initial conjunction of gnosis and magic. Within the context of the theory, the world view, what the Germans would call Weltanschauung, cosmo conception, world conception, the importance of something that might be called magic immediately arises. Because how will Simon and those whom he teaches get off the ground, and I use that term advisedly, and rise in consciousness or otherwise aloft, above the stars, to the source? How can the return to the original condition of the spirit be accomplished? And that accomplishment is the sphere here of magic. Now, there are always two factors involved in this sort of thing, and both need to be taken into consideration, in my view. One of them is the element that in the Christian tradition particularly came to be called, or at least summed up under the term and the concept of grace. Grace is something that you don't do. Grace is something that comes to you as a gift from a high and holy source. And grace is really based, you know, giving it a little Gnostic twist here now, after all, you know, grace in that sense is based on the idea that not only do we long for the ineffable greatness, or God, or whatever you wish to call it, but the ineffable greatness also longs for us. It's a two-way street. we have become separated. And while we perhaps suffer more from that separation than anyone else, there is reaching out on the part of the other party for us also. This reaching out is grace. And the embodiments of messengers of light, such as Simon, such as Helen, such as Jesus, such as Mani, such as Buddha, and so forth, whichever way you want to look at it, are all manifestations of that grace that comes toward us. But that is not all. Unfortunately, in mainstream non-Gnostic Christianity, for the most part, it became everything. The view became somewhat unbalanced. We came to depend entirely on grace. Well, some theologies more than others, but still the idea always was that the saving impulse comes from above, and then we have to kind of merit it, go along with it, observe the commandments, observe the rules, make ourselves worthy of the operations of grace. But in the Gnostic view, there is really more to it than that. And the reason there is more to it than that is because in the Gnostic view, the human is not merely a creature. and, you know, creature is just really means creatura in Latin, a created being. But we, for some reason, we have come to use a pejorative term with creature. And we even had a, you know, I love monster movies and things like that, as some of you know. So there was years ago on television a series of rather second-class monster movies, and it was called The Creature Feature. that's creature doesn't mean that. It doesn't have to be a monster, but a created thing. In part, says the Gnosis, we are created beings. But in part, we are really of the same essence as our source. And so with that essence, when we get hold of it, when we stir up that fire, to use Simon's term, within us, with that we can reach out toward the ineffable. And then somewhere in the intermediate regions, in these magical worlds where the soul travels, we meet. The impulse from below, the impulse from above meet, rather like the fingers of God and man on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Now, this reaching out from our position, from our part toward the ultimate, this is where the magic comes in. And it is universally believed that Simon was a magician because he did that kind of thing. But once again, the church fathers and his enemies, so forth, corrupted and perverted these accounts. That would be their want. Instead of a spiritual and symbolic statement of Simon's magic, they made something very physical out of it. It might not even have been entirely the result of malice that they did this, but it's that reductionistic, that kind of heletic mind. The same kind of heletic mind that couldn't see, let's say, beyond the physical miracles of Jesus. Jesus is tremendously important because he performed physical miracles. And as Morton Smith, in his account of the secret gospel of Mark, and in his book Jesus the Magician, points out, physical miraculous deeds were not that uncommon at that time. There were sort of itinerant miracle producers, thaumaturgs, all over the place. They were even raising dead people, at least so they said. Who knows, might have been like in voodoo or things of that sort, where people become cataleptic. They're completely knocked out, they look like dead. And then the witch doctors, or whatever you want to call them, the wizards, wake them up, and then they become zombies. But whatever the case may be, the Gnostic never could get too excited about these physical miracles. They always said, all right, yeah, but you know, that's not what's important. There is something else that is important. And here too, there is something else that is important. Now, the accusers of Simon are all saying constantly, Simon's big deal was that he knew how to fly magically. Get up and fly. Yeah. And one of the stories which recounted over and over again is that he did this, he demonstrated it in front of the emperor in Rome. According to some accounts, the emperor Nero. Well, if you were in Nero's presence, you probably wanted to fly away from there to begin with, because he wasn't all that nice a man. He was very, very crazy. And according to others, in front of the emperor Claudius, who was a much nicer man, the same family, however, which would have been a little bit earlier than Nero. But whatever, then the story goes that someone else, probably Saint Peter, was there, and that Peter then did his orthodox counter magic and made Simon fall down. Yet, at the same time, they also say that in Rome, a statue was erected to Simon. And that the inscription on the statue was, Simon, the great power of the gods. Now, if he had been made to crash, and he had become this discredited flying flying magician in Rome, it's not so likely that they would have erected the statue to him, which apparently was there for quite a long time. So, who knows? In any event, there is something to the flight. And if I can get hold of it among my volumes of wisdom here, I'll read you a little account about that. A Syriac manuscript translated in the 15th century by an alchemist, the alchemist named Malku, writes about Simon Magus as follows. Simon, laying his face upon the ground, whispered in her ear, her being earth in this case, O Mother Earth, give me, I pray thee, some of thy breath, and I will give thee mine. Let me loose, O Mother, and the let me loose is in capital letters, that I may carry thy words to the stars, and I will return faithfully and bless thee after a while. And the earth, strengthening her status, none to her detriment, sent her genius to breathe of her breath on Simon, her genius meaning her spirit, an earth spirit, on Simon, while he breathed on her, and the stars rejoiced to be visited by the Mighty One, as he flew up. Now, what is this? Is this an act of someone who just wants to fly around the countryside without a helicopter or something of that sort? A pre-jet age flight? Or is it really something else? Magic? It is, yes. But not that kind of magic. It is a magic that enlists the aid of the earth, in this case, of the element on which we stand, in order to get beyond the earth. Now, that is a very important principle. I read once, and I never, it was in the days when I didn't write down the sources of quotations, even though I remember it well. I read once in a Hindu source. It was one of the tantric scriptures, one of the tantras, in which the statement was made, he who wishes to lift himself up, raise himself up from the ground, must do so with the aid of the ground. Here it is, exactly, you see. Now, of course, one has to be wise in that connection, but it is true. Let's say, just to show analogies, and I don't by any means mean to put these analogies all on a level with each other, because they are very different. But let's say Jesus himself, in order to perpetuate his mystical presence among his disciples, uses a couple of earthly substances, a bread and a wine. And then he says, do this. Go on and keep doing this in remembrance of me. He didn't just use spirit. He used uses something physical. And so it is in many other situations. But one needs to keep in mind that this physical assistance, this physical aid, is the contribution of the physical world to your spiritual upliftment, quite literally in this case. Now, please don't excoriate me afterwards or throw rotten vegetables at me or anything of that sort, which I'm not a vegetarian, I'm not a vegetable either. After all, it's these health people who always say you are what you eat, so if I were a vegetarian, I would be a vegetable. But that doesn't mean that I'm a steak. Okay. Now then, let's get away from that. It's really too silly. But don't misunderstand it. But let's say also that there is more and more evidence accumulating as the result of very reputable research that from ancient times on, among the Hindus with their soma, among the ancient Persians with their hauma, the Greeks with the Eleusinian mystery with the Kekeion and so forth, probably right down to our times of LSD and things of that sort, that certain physical agencies have been used within a ceremonial and ritual mystery setting in order to induce extraordinary states of consciousness, which then were used for mystical purposes. Now, there's a lot of argument about that sort of thing, and I'm not going to enter these arguments, but all of these are examples of how the breath of the earth, something coming from the physical side of things, may be used in order to rise beyond and above the stars. Simon was also accused of trying to buy the spiritual gifts, the spiritual power from Saint Peter and the apostles. And later on in history, the term simony or simony arose from that, which is a term of the malfeasance of buying ecclesiastical offices for money. So, for instance, if you go up to Cardinal Mahony and say to him, Your Eminence, I want to be ordained a priest and made a Monsignor and given a very beautiful parish with a great big church somewhere, here are whatever it is, $100,000, that would be simony, you know. But if Rupert Murdoch gives a cardinal that much for his new cathedral and then is made a knight of St. Gregory and a number of other things, although he is a thoroughly disreputable character, otherwise that is not simony, that is just the way things are done, okay? Here again, I think we can see, if we so desire, if we look through the accusation, and if we put that together with another part of the tradition, which I think is probably actually in the Acts of the Apostles, although the sources run together in my mind, that even the calumniators of Simon say in the end, and then at the very end of it, he let all this go, and he really joined the apostles, and he became a good Christian. But if you put that together with the idea that he was trying to buy the apostolic power from the apostles, then you may perhaps conjecture by these distortions that Simon recognized the apostolic succession and some of the mysteries that were developing among the followers of Jesus, and that he perhaps wanted to get in on it. Perhaps he wanted to show his sympathy. But certainly there were followers of Simon quite a bit later. Almost a century later, there are reports that practically the entire province of Samaria, where he came from, consisted purely of followers of Simon. So that Simonians were quite numerous. It was an important early school of gnosis and of these sorts of mysteries. And yet I would conclude on the note that I don't think it is fortuitous that the first known Gnostic also bore the name magician. Of course, his figure continued, as I think I may have mentioned at another time, in literature, because one of the names by which he was also known, sort of a title, was Faustus. Faustus meaning the fortunate one. And that therefore the legend of Faust, or Dr. Faustus, in Middle Ages or in the Renaissance period, which was, of course, written about extensively both by Goethe and by Marlowe, is based on the Simon tradition, because Dr. Faustus, as you may recall, in both of the great dramas, magically conjures Helen of Troy. He brings Helen of Troy back to life. This is the Faustian motive. It has also been noted, and it's rather easy to discern, that the story of Don Quixote de la Mancha bears very close resemblance on its own level within the knightly and the Spanish mythos to the story of Faust. Because here also Don Quixote de la Mancha in the lowly kitchen maid recognizes the great lady, and it takes quite a bit of convincing, as you may recall, before she accepts the idea that she is really Dulcinea. But the motive is there of the feminine principle and the feminine wisdom, Helen Sophia, who has been degraded and thrown into the world and enslaved and abused and who has forgotten who she is. That then the rescuer comes from on high and reminds her of who she is and restores her to her proper place, which is beside him as the teaching and sanctifying agent in the world. So all of this is a kind of magic. And just how that magic is, let's say, implemented at a much more vastly expanded and archetypal level in tremendously elaborate poetic and literary form in the story of Sophia. To that, our next discussion relating to the magic of Sophia and to Pistis Sophia will be devoted. There you find actual formulae, you might say, magical incantations, magical poetry, magical words, which are used there in the liberation of Sophia and in her rising to the higher levels. So I hope that that may be of interest to you. Meanwhile, if you are able to, then have a little cup of coffee and refreshments with us. And thank you very much for your attention.
Copyright MMS, BC Recordings, catalog number 301408. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org, that's gnosis.org.